Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's a really special pleasure to be able to be with you this evening. I've been doing a lot of speaking over the years, and I was growing tired of listening to myself talk, and then one evening, my website manager, Peter Ilias, he sent me this video. He said, you may want to listen to it. And he said it was rap, which is not my cup of tea. But I clicked it on, and Long Live Palestine came on by Loki, and I found myself transfixed. I just kept on listening to it and listening to it. It was not just the music, I felt it was just the right message. He was saying the right things, basically, to use the expression of my generation, we were on the same wavelength, and the expression of your generation, we were on the same page. And so I dropped Loki an email, and he wrote me back, and I said, well, let's try to get together and see maybe we can do something together. And a few weeks later, he said, there's this fellow, Jody McIntyre, who is willing to come on his own, no sponsorship, and can he join us? I didn't really know Jody. I said, okay, sure, bring him along. And as you can see, Jody is quite a remarkable young man. Our first evening together was in, can't remember now, and it was only Tuesday, but it was somewhere in the Midwest. And I flew in, and Jody shows up, and I said, well, how did you come? He said, well, I took a bus. It took 26 hours. And he didn't skip a beat. No naps, no nothing. He's like a perpetual motion machine. Then Loki began to worry. He said, I don't think your crowd's the one to listen to rap. But that turned out to be wrong also. And I think now it's beginning to work. The question is, where do I fit in? Actually, at this age, I would be very happy to be replaced and displaced. But for now, I'm with you, and I feel good about being with you because I'm among friends. Many of you I had as students, and many of you I came to know during my years in Chicago. And it's a kind of homecoming. So thank you for showing up this evening. I want to speak about what happened in Gaza during those 22 days from December 27th to January 18th, the 22 days that Amnesty International called the days of death and destruction. Now, it might seem a kind of curiosity, almost an eccentricity. Why talk about Gaza? Wars occur with such frequency and disappear from consciousness with such rapidity that a year and a half later, it ought to be old news. But in fact, Gaza doesn't go away. It's a ghost which refuses to be buried. It's a shadow that Israel can't evade. And one of the obvious questions is, what makes Gaza different? Why won't Gaza go away? Let me begin with some of the background to how those 22 days came to unfold. It's always arbitrary where you begin a chronology. I'll begin with January 2006, when there were parliamentary elections in the occupied Palestinian territories. And Hamas, the Islamic movement, won. According to Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, the elections were completely honest and fair. In response to those completely honest and fair elections, Israel and then the U.S. imposed economic sanctions on the people of Palestine, the people of Gaza. In January or June 2007, Israel, the United States, and some elements in the Palestinian Authority, they tried to overthrow the legally elected government in Gaza. In the United States, that's called democracy promotion. Hamas resisted. The Palestinian elements were sent packing to the West Bank, and now Hamas had full control of Gaza. Israel, backed by the United States, then imposed or tightened the economic blockade of Gaza, a blockade that Amnesty International called a flagrant violation of international law. The Goldstone Report, to which I'll get to presently, it said the blockade was a possible crime against humanity. The former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, she journeyed to Gaza during these months, and she said, "Gaza's whole civilization has been destroyed. I'm not exaggerating. Its whole civilization has been destroyed." In June 2008, Hamas and Israel entered into a ceasefire, and each side had obligations under the ceasefire. Hamas was supposed to cease its rocket and mortar attacks on Israel, and Israel was supposed to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza, the blockade which is a flagrant violation of international law, the blockade which was destroying Gaza's civilization. According to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hamas, and now I'm quoting it, was careful to maintain the ceasefire. There were some what Israel calls rogue terrorist organizations, not Hamas, but others, who didn't fully honor the ceasefire, but Israel said, and now I'm quoting, "Hamas enforced the ceasefire on the rogue terrorist organizations with a great deal, although not complete success." So Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel, however, reneged on its obligation to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza. Well, what happened next? It's not hard to find. All you have to do is turn to Amnesty International's yearbook for 2008, and this is what they write. "A ceasefire agreed in June between Israel and Palestinian armed groups in Gaza. It held for 4.5 months, but it broke down after Israeli forces killed 6 Palestinian militants in airstrikes and other attacks on November 4th. Israel patiently waited until the day of the U.S. elections, the historic elections, when the media and public opinion would be riveted to the result. And on that day, it attacked Gaza and killed 6 Palestinians, knowing full well that would cause a breakdown in the ceasefire. And it did break down. But until the end of December, Hamas kept saying, 'We're willing to renew the ceasefire. We're willing to renew the ceasefire.' But Israel has to implement the original terms of the ceasefire. It has to lift the blockade of Gaza, that flagrant violation of international law, which was destroying the civilization. Israel said no. It said that it had to be unconditional and unilateral Hamas cessation of rocket fire. By December 2008, Sarah Roy of Harvard the world's leading authority in the Gaza economy, and as it happens, the daughter of survivors of Auschwitz concentration camp, Professor Roy wrote, "The breakdown of an entire society is happening in front of us, but there is little international response beyond UN warnings, which are ignored." And now Hamas had really only two stark options. One was to acquiesce in the starvation of the people of Gaza, and the second one was to fight. Hamas opted for resistance, although largely symbolic resistance. The former Israeli commander in Gaza, he said at this time, "You cannot just land blows, leave the Palestinians in Gaza in the economic distress they're in, and expect that Hamas will just sit around and do nothing." In the midst of the invasion, Hamas's leader Khaled Mishaal said, "Our modest homemade rockets are our cry of protest to the world." What were those rockets, if not a message to an indifferent world? SOS, we're dying. SOS, we're dying. It's easy enough to condemn the Hamas rocket attacks, but it seems to me you have to also show what other option they had. Otherwise, critics of Hamas are in effect saying that the people of Gaza had a legal moral obligation to just lie still and die. On December 27th, Israel began its invasion of Gaza. It ended 22 days later. Nowadays, when you hear about those 22 days, we're told there was a war in Gaza. The Gaza War, we're told. Israel itself tries to justify what happened, the death and destruction, by saying, well, after all, we were confronted with an asymmetrical war against a terrorist organization. And then there are the fog of war conditions. There's a lot of confusion in the course of a war. Split-second decisions have to be made. Innocents get killed unintentionally. Places aren't targeted erroneously. That's what happens in war. But all of that argument is premised on one fact. The premise is there was a war in Gaza. But was there a war in Gaza? After those 22 days, Israelis were very proud of what happened. They went around boasting, now we've shown those Arabs who's who and what's what, because they suffered a significant defeat in July, August 2006 in Lebanon, and they were fearful that what they call their deterrence capacity was being diminished. Deterrence capacity is just a fancy technical term designed to intimidate people. All it means is the Arab world's fear of Israel had apparently declined after the defeat Israel suffered in Lebanon. The head of the Hezbollah, Mr. Nasrallah, he was going around saying that the Arabs no longer fear Israel. And he was taunting the Israelis. He said, come on, attack us again, and we'll defeat you again. So Israel wanted to restore its deterrence capacity in Gaza. And it said, now we've restored it, because we won the war in Gaza. We defeated the people of Hamas. We won the war. But then along came an Israeli strategic analyst, and he said, it's very dangerous for Israel to believe it won the war when there was no war. In reality, not a single battle was fought during the 22 days of fighting. A former Israeli foreign ministry official said, there was no war. Hamas sat in its bunkers and came out when it was all over. So what happened in Gaza? The basic facts are not too complicated. Israel began the first week with an air assault on Gaza. And by the end of the 22 days, it flew between 2,800 and 3,000 air combat missions over Gaza. All 3,000 planes came back. None were downed. None were even hit, which is not too surprising because the Palestinians had no anti-aircraft defenses to speak of. Then Israel launched, at the beginning of the second week, its ground invasion. The Israeli army was equipped with special night fighting technology. Hamas couldn't even see them. So what happened in Gaza? Actually, we have some very excellent testimony. You might call it unimpeachable testimony. The testimony of the soldiers who were there and afterwards testify to what they experienced. So what happened? Soldier. There was nothing there. Ghost towns. Except for some livestock, nothing moved. Soldier. Most of the time it was boring. There were not really too many events. Soldier. I did not see one single Arab the whole time we were there, that whole week. Soldier, everyone was disappointed about not engaging anyone. Soldier, usually we did not see a living soul, except for our soldiers, of course, not a soul. Soldier, go ahead, ask the other soldiers how often they encountered combatants in Gaza. Nothing, no one. Soldier, there was supposed to be a tiny resistance force upon entry, but there just wasn't. No battles, no enemy in the field, no tangling with the foe, no fog of war conditions because there was no war. But that's only half the story. The other half, it's easy enough for you yourselves to check. Just when you get home, enter under the Google search function, enter breaking the silence. And if you enter breaking the silence, what will come up on your screen is a collection of soldier testimonies. And then enter the word insane in the search function. And if you enter the word insane, it comes up once, twice, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, insane, insane, insane. Insane, insane, insane. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. The soldiers were interviewed separately. They weren't cueing each other, but that's the word that kept leaping to their mind. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. No battles, no fighting, no enemy in the field, but Israel was using insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. One soldier said, "This was firepower such as I had never known. There were blasts all the time. The earth was constantly shaking." Another soldier said, "On the ground you hear these thunderous blasts all day long. I mean, not just tank shelling, which was a tune we'd long gotten used to, but blasts that actually rocked the outpost to the extent that some of us were ordered out of the house we were quartered in for fear it would collapse." The Israeli soldiers commandeered Palestinian homes in Gaza. Were firing into the horizon, but the ground underneath their feet was shaking so much, they were told to leave the houses because the houses might collapse on them. So what happened in Gaza? Well, actually, the Israeli soldiers, I think, were most ingenious in coming up with the best metaphors. One soldier said, "It felt like hunting season had begun. Sometimes it reminded me of PlayStation computer game." Another soldier said, "You feel like a child playing around with a magnifying glass burning up ants." You felt like a child with a magnifying glass burning up ants. I was a kid once, and I remember, I don't say it with any kind of pride, I had my magnifying glass. I focused the rays of the sun, burned up the ant hills, turned the ants to crispy critters. But I wasn't so delusional as to think I was engaged in a war with the ants. In fact, the metaphor of burning up ants was perfect, I think. Among Israel's tools of the trade, which I have to emphasize, are all made literally, we're not using hyperbole, they're all made in the USA. Among Israel's tools of the trade are the white phosphorus shells. I've heard about the white phosphorus, read about it many times in reading about Israel's prior engagements with its neighbors, but I never really looked at the details. And this time I did. Human Rights Watch put out a good report entitled "Rain of Fire." White phosphorus, it reaches a temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, 816 degrees Celsius. As Oprah Winfrey would say, try wrapping your mind around that. So what did Israel do with the white phosphorus shells? Human Rights Watch says, and now I'm quoting it, "Israel repeatedly exploded white phosphorus munitions in the air over populated areas, killing and injuring civilians and damaging civilian structures. Israel used white phosphorus in a school, a market, a humanitarian aid warehouse, and on hospitals. Israel dropped white phosphorus on Al-Quds Hospital. Israel dropped white phosphorus in Al-Wafa Hospital. According to Human Rights Watch, the hospitals were clearly marked, and there does not appear to have been fighting in that immediate area. By the end of those 22 days, 1,400 Palestinians were killed, of whom up to four-fifths were civilians. About 355 were children. On the Israeli side, 13 Israelis were killed, of whom 10 were combatants, and of those 10 combatants, half were killed by other Israelis by accident, what's called friendly fire. And 3 civilians were killed. So, in total, for every 100 Palestinians were killed, 1 Israeli was killed. For every 400 Palestinian civilians that were killed, 1 Israeli civilian was killed. That's not a war, that's a massacre. Every time you refer to what happened during those days as the Gaza War, you become, wittingly or unwittingly, an instrument of Israeli propaganda. After the massacre in Gaza, Israel tried to justify what it did, its most egregious acts. So Israel attacked and destroyed 29 ambulances and almost half of Gaza's 122 health facilities, including 15 hospitals. Israel said, you have to understand, Hamas, those cowardly lunatic terrorists, they were using the hospitals as a refuge for their militants. Many human rights organizations investigated that claim, and they all reached the same conclusion. Everyone. There's no evidence at all that Hamas used the hospitals as refuge. Then Israel claimed, well, the reason we damaged or destroyed 29 ambulances is because Hamas was ferrying militants and weapons in those ambulances. A lot of human rights organizations investigated the claim. They said there's no evidence. Even Magen David Adom, the Israeli version of the National Emergency Medical Disaster Ambulance and Blood Bank Service, Magen David Adom testified, and now I'm quoting them, there was no use of Palestinian Red Crescent Society ambulances for the transport of weapons or ammunition. But Israel damaged or destroyed 29 ambulances. Israel destroyed 30 mosques and damaged 15 more. Israel claimed that the mosques were used to store weapons. The Goldstone mission, to which again I'll return in a few moments, the Goldstone mission investigated one of the attacks on the mosque, what it called an intentional Israeli attack on a mosque that killed at least 15 people attending religious service. The Goldstone mission concluded, and now I'm quoting it, there's no evidence that this mosque was used for the storage of weapons or any military activity by Palestinian armed groups. Well, Israel says maybe that, not that mosque, but other mosques were being used to store weapons. Well, but there's a problem there too. The problem is Israel didn't just target the mosques in Gaza. It systematically targeted the minarets on the mosques in Gaza. The minarets in Gaza don't have staircases, and they were too narrow for snipers to ascend. So why were they systematically targeting the minarets? The distinguished South African jurist John Dugard, he headed up a fact-finding committee, and his conclusion was, and now I'm quoting him, the mosques, and more particularly the minarets, had been targeted on the grounds that they symbolized Islam. Well, that's a good reason. You can't quarrel with that. Now, of course, Israel had a last line of defense, which all of you are familiar with, of course, the claim that those nasty lunatic cowardly Islamic fundamentalists, they were using the Palestinian population in Gaza as human shields. They were hiding purposely behind the Palestinian civilian population in order to protect themselves from an Israeli attack. And so Israel had no choice but to kill civilians because Hamas was using them as human shields. How many of you are familiar with that claim by Israel? Raise your hand up high. So we could say nearly everyone. In fact, you'd have to have been suffering from a degenerative brain disease or an excessive consumption of mind-altering drugs not to have heard it. But what did human rights organizations find? So let's take the most respected human rights organization in the world, Amnesty International. And now I'm quoting it. Contrary to repeated allegations by Israeli officials of the use of human shields, Amnesty International found no evidence that Hamas or other Palestinian fighters directed the movement of civilians to shield military objectives from attacks. Amnesty International found no evidence that Hamas or other armed groups forced residents to sit in or around buildings used by fighters. Amnesty International found no evidence that fighters prevented residents from leaving buildings or areas which had been commandeered by militants. There's just no evidence. Now, nearly everyone in this room raised his or her hand when asked, were you familiar with the Israeli claim that Hamas was engaging in human shielding? How many of you are aware that the human rights organizations found no evidence? Raise your hand. Well, look around. You could say at best about 5%. Even if it were true, that Hamas engaged in human shielding, it still couldn't explain the deaths in Gaza. Why? Let's hear what Amnesty had to say. The attacks that caused the greatest number of fatalities and injuries, while the people were not caught in the crossfire of battles between Palestinian militants and Israeli forces. What were the people doing? Many were killed when their homes were bombed while they slept. Others were going about their daily activities in their homes, sitting in their yard, hanging the laundry on the roof, when they were targeted in airstrikes or tank shelling. How did those children die? Amnesty says the children were studying or playing in their bedrooms or on the roof or outside their homes when they were struck by missiles or tank shells. Now, it's not true that there was no human shielding in Gaza. No, there was a lot of human shielding in Gaza. But it was Israel that was using Palestinians as human shields. All the human rights organizations, of which there were many, which investigated what happened in Gaza, they all concluded that Israel committed multiple war crimes and possibly or definitely crimes against humanity. They also concluded that Hamas committed comparable crimes, but on an incomparably smaller scale. How many crimes can ants commit against a child, incinerating them with a magnifying glass? After those 22 days of destruction, death and destruction, there were many human rights investigations as to what happened. In April 2009, the UN Human Rights Council appointed a fact-finding mission to investigate what happened. And it appointed as the head of the mission Richard Goldstone, the former prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. He headed up the mission. His main findings, it's a very substantial report. It came to about 500 pages, the full Goldstone report. The main findings were, and now I'm quoting, Israel used deliberately disproportionate attack, excuse me, Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. A deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. And then the Goldstone mission had to ask the question, did it happen because of a few rotten apples among the Israeli soldiers? Some soldiers who went berserk, who had gone awry? Well, Goldstone mission concluded, no, that can't be. And now I'm quoting it. The systematic and deliberate nature of the activities leave the mission in no doubt that responsibility lies in the first place with those who designed, planned, ordered, and oversaw the operations. That is to say, the chief responsibility was that of the political and military elites in Israel. And in fact, it was very hard to contest that conclusion because before, during, and after the attack, the Israeli leaders were very open about what they intended to do, what they were doing, and then what they did do. So the head of Israel's Northern Command, he said before the attack, we will yield disproportionate power against every village from which shots are fired in Israel. We will cause immense damage and destruction. The former head of Israel's National Security Council, he said, the next war will lead to intense suffering among the enemy population, the destruction of homes and infrastructure, and the suffering of hundreds of thousands of people. During the attack, Israel's foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, she said, Hamas now understands that when you fire on Israel's citizens, it responds by going wild, and that is a good thing. The day after the attack, Ms. Livni went on Channel 10 News in Israel, and she said, Israel demonstrated real hooliganism during the course of the recent operation, which is what I demanded. And a strange thing happened. A few months later, Ms. Livni, the foreign minister, she traveled, then the foreign minister, I should say during the Gaza massacre, the foreign minister, she traveled to the UK, and some citizens presented her with papers charging her with war crimes. And Ms. Livni was shocked. She was bewildered. She was completely perplexed. She thought that real hooliganism was protected by the Geneva Conventions. A former Israeli defense official said, with an armada of fighter planes attacking Gaza, Israel decided to play the role of a mad dog for the sake of future deterrence. A former senior Israeli security official boasted that Israel had regained its deterrence because it has shown Hamas, Iran, and the region that it can be as lunatic as any of them. Lunatic, mad dog, real hooliganism, wild, immense suffering. What else was the Goldstone mission supposed to conclude except that Israel used disproportionate force designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population, and that senior Israeli officials were responsible? After the Goldstone report came out, it created a real hysteria across the spectrum, the political spectrum in Israel. We'll leave aside what's called the right wing in Israel and look at what are called the doves, or at least they're called doves in the West. So along came the president of Israel, Mr. Shimon Peres, and he said of the Goldstone report, it's a mockery of history. And Goldstone, he's a small man devoid of any sense of justice. And then Mr. Peres, the Nobel Peace Laureate, he wanted to set the record straight about Israel's military might. So he said, anyone here from the West Bank, raise your hand. Raise your hand, okay. So you can confirm his grasp on history. He said it's Israeli military operations that brought economic prosperity in the West Bank. Anyone here from Lebanon, raise your hand. Okay. Well, Mr. Peres said it was Israeli military operations that liberated Lebanon from the wrath of Hezbollah. And then what happened in Gaza? Mr. Peres said the Israeli military operation is what enabled Gaza residents to return to their daily routine. Well, thank you very much for that. The Israeli ambassador to the United States, a fellow who goes by the name of Michael Oren, some people think he's a historian. Mr. Oren said that the Goldstone report was worse than Ahmadinejad and the Holocaust deniers, which you'll have to agree is pretty bad. And then along came the Harvard Law professor, Alan Dershowitz. He called the Goldstone report, he said, it's so filled with lies, distortions, and blood libels that it could have been drafted by Hamas extremists. He said it recalled the protocols of the elders of Zion. He said Goldstone was an evil man, an absolute traitor. And as we know from Sinclair Lewis's Elmer Gantry, every circus needs a clown. So along came Elie Wiesel, who called the report a crime against the Jewish people. The interesting question, and the question to which we should attend this evening, is why did the Goldstone report evoke such hysteria? It was in fact the last in a long line of reports on what happened in Gaza. Human Rights Watch put out 5 reports. Last week it put out a 6th report on Gaza. Human Rights, excuse me, Amnesty International put out two very large reports on Gaza, and then there were many Palestinian human rights organizations, Israeli human rights organizations, independent international missions and fact-finding committees, and they all reached roughly the same conclusions as Mr. Goldstone's mission. In fact, one can argue that the Goldstone report was the most conservative, cautious, and judicious of all the reports. So why did it evoke such a hysteria? Well, the answer is not so hard to find. Mr. Goldstone is not only Jewish, but he's a self-declared Zionist. He says, "I work for Israel all of my adult life. I fully support Israel's right to exist. I'm a firm believer in the absolute right of the Jewish people to have their home there." Mr. Goldstone sits in the board of governors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He received an honorary doctorate from the Hebrew University. His mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. His daughter did a Zionist emigration to Israel. Mr. Goldstone says, "It was because of the Nazi Holocaust that I entered the field of human rights and international law." So now Israel had a real problem with Mr. Goldstone, because for the last several decades, it's honed these ideological weapons to discredit any critic of Israel. So if you criticize Israel, it must be because you're an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew or a Holocaust denier. But Mr. Goldstone's person, he neutralized the ideological weapons, and now Israel had nothing left to hide behind. As the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy put it, this time the messenger is propaganda proof. Well, Mr. Goldstone, he doesn't look like your typical anti-Semite. He doesn't sound like your typical self-hating Jew. He says, "I love Israel. I'm a Zionist. I've worked my entire adult life for Israel." He doesn't seem like your typical Holocaust denier. He says, "It was the Holocaust that was the impetus for me going into international law and human rights law." If he was not an anti-Semite, he was not a self-hating Jew, he was not a Holocaust denier, if he was neither an incompetent nor a fool, and the former chief prosecutor for war crimes in Yugoslavia and Rwanda doesn't sound like an incompetent or a fool, then there was only one possible conclusion. And the only possible conclusion is that the devastating content of the report he authored was accurate. It was true. And so Israel entered into, or went into, panic mode. The events in Gaza and then the Goldstone report, they mark you can never say these things with certainty, but they mark a turning point in the public's awareness and understanding of what's happening in the occupied territories. And it's posing a real challenge for Jews in particular, because most Jews are Jewish. Most Jews are liberal. 80%, they are. 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama in the last election. Among Latinos, it was about 67%. And among whites in general, it was about 43%. If you factor in that Jews are by far and away the wealthiest ethnic group in the United States, they should be voting overwhelmingly Republican. They should certainly be voting more Republican than Latinos, but no, Jews are liberal. And liberal basically means, in the American context, it means support for the rule of law, international institutions, human rights organizations. Amnesty International is a liberal organization. Human Rights Watch is a liberal organization. And now it's become virtually impossible for Jews, who are overwhelmingly liberal, to defend Israeli policy and conduct, especially when it's human rights organizations that are condemning Israeli policy, especially when it's the figure of a Richard Goldstone who's condemning Israeli policy. And so now it's quite possible that we'll see the breakup of the blind support of Israel among Jews and among the public in general. And that now poses a real challenge to us, because at the end of the day, we're gathered here because we want to figure out what to do, not just to mourn, but also to organize. And so we have to figure out what to do. And here I think it's useful to take some lessons from the fellow, the Mahatma, Mr. Gandhi from India. I spent about a year reading through part of his collected works. Gandhi, his collected works come to about 100 volumes, and each volume is 500 pages. So it's a formidable undertaking to make one's way through it. And there's the other challenge that most of what Gandhi wrote had very little to do with politics. He was obsessed by diet and good health. And so most of his writing is given over to home cures for everything from constipation to impotence. That was Gandhi's main interest. But of course, he had also a political life and a substantial, though I don't think a predominant, aspect of his writing was given over to politics. And Mr. Gandhi, as you know, he championed this doctrine called nonviolent resistance. Originally, it was called passive resistance, and Gandhi didn't like that term at all because he felt that nonviolence is just not passive. It's very active. He said it's the most active form of resistance there is. And so he tried to find a new term to symbolize and embody his doctrine. And the term he came up with, as many of you know, is satyagraha. And he translates satyagraha as hold on to the truth, which is an image I kind of like, the idea of grasping and clinging to your last breath, to the truth. Hold on to the truth. And I think that's our challenge, to hold on to the truth, that what Israel has done to the Palestinians is wrong, and it's indefensible. To hold on to the truth that a diplomatic settlement of the conflict is within reach. But it's Israel's refusal, backed by the U.S., to respect international law that's preventing a resolution of the conflict. If we learn how to wield the weapon of truth, the weapon as it's recorded in the findings of the human rights community, if we learn how to hold on to the weapon of justice, as it's embodied in the uncontroversial principles of international law. If we learn how to wield the weapons of truth and justice, and if we show a little fortitude, just a thousandth part, or as Frederick Douglass used to say, a 10,000th part of the courage and fortitude of Jody McIntyre, and I mean that literally, just a 10,000th part, then I think a settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict is within reach. I want to just end on one last note. I think we should all be sensitive to the fact that our aim is not to vilify, and our aim is not to vanquish, and our aim is not to feel glee at exposing a ruthless foe. Our aim is we want to settle the conflict. That should be uppermost in our minds. As the African American spiritual used to put it, we have to keep our eyes on the prize. And the prize is to end the occupation and for once and for all, to let everyone, and I want to underline everyone in that area, to lead proud, productive, and peaceful lives. and so We have to reach out to everyone who is willing to be principled. Nobody's asking for the sun, the moon, the stars, and the sky. We're asking people to be principled, to respect basic principles of international law and basic principles of justice. I, for one, don't think we should accept anything less. I like the line by the Mahatma. He used to say, "I'm all for compromise, but not on principles." Because when you start compromising principles, he said, it becomes all give and no take. So we want to be principled, but we also want to be reasonable. We want to show everyone there is a way out and that everybody is welcome so long as you're reasonable. The late Edward Said, at the end of his life, he liked to quote the Caribbean poet M.A. Cesar, and the line he liked to quote was, "There's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory." There's room for everyone. Just be reasonable. Allow the Palestinians to have the same right to human dignity and the same right to human equality as everyone. And then you're welcome. Not just you're welcome. We want you there at that rendezvous of victory. And I'm perfectly confident, I really am. I know you're supposed to end these things on an uplifting note, but I just don't do it for that reason. I am perfectly confident if we arm ourselves with the weapon of truth, we learn the facts, and we're reasonable, that we'll all be there, and I still intend to be there. We'll all be there together at the rendezvous of victory. Thank you.